So this session we're going to be talking about multiple perspectives, points of views and spanners in the works. So when is it a good idea to have lots of different points of views? When is it a good idea to have alignment? All those kinds of things. So Toby, do you have any thoughts you want to kick this off with?
So I think that I'll just go back to my requisite coherence thread. It's just a lovely set of words. To what degree do we need to be aligned in order to work effectively together? I think that's, to me, is the core sort of viewpoint I tend, the lens I use in thinking about this. And I can see both the usefulness in adding additional points of views, and I can see instances and circumstances where, at least for the moment, it's better to not introduce an extra viewpoint because we need to sort of move at speed. And I think that's what I'm thinking about.
And I was just thinking about facilitating a workshop. So one area when we want to get lots of different perspectives is when we do brainstorming. And, you know, the old-fashioned view of brainstorming was someone like me standing up the front in front of a whiteboard or a piece of butcher's paper and saying, okay, what are people's thoughts? Let's shout them out. And so someone shouts out, you know, if we're talking about food, brie. Okay, I can guarantee you if you start with brie or some kind of cheese, for the rest of the session, everyone is going to collapse around that thought. And you're going to get a series of different types of cheese, maybe some other dairy products if you're lucky, but not much more than that. So if we're wanting to get a lot of different inputs and a big range of ideas, it's better to do what's called silent brainstorming. So that's when post-it notes come in really handy. You say, okay, we're going to talk about food. Before anyone says anything, I want you to sit down and write three different things before you talk to anyone else. And that way we're going to get a lot of different points of view and we're not going to collapse around an idea too quickly. But you don't need to do that all the time. You only do that when you really want to get a big scan of what are all the options or different things that we want to look at.
And I think that's, so this is a bit of a tangent, but I think this is actually such an important thing to really stress when it comes to the idea of brainstorming and gathering ideas, how that change actually also invites not only a broader range of perspectives because we don't anchor to the first thing, but it actually makes it much easier for introverts, or at least the less extroverted or less outwardly oriented people in the room, to actually contribute their ideas and have their voices heard. So I think that it's actually a great equalizer in that too. That's sort of, if we really do want multiple perspectives, then structuring the exercise or the working environment in order for that to happen is super important. And it will come at the cost of, in this case, the strong voices and the extroverts. But the strong voices and the extroverts, they tend to fend for themselves pretty well either way, actually. But what's the correct amount of divergent thought in this case? How many viewpoints do we actually need?
Because we wouldn't be able to process too many. I mean, I've done a series of workshops where I've asked people to write things on post-it notes. And once you get something like 10 people in a room or 15 people in a room and they write 10 things, you've suddenly got 100 or 150 items of material. And no one can take that in and deal with 150 items of material in a normal workshop period properly. So that's the other thing is, I like that point. How much is too much? How much can we actually deal with? And how much should we allow for so that we're scanning broadly enough to get the multiple perspectives but still having time to process them and do something useful with them? So I think there is that tension between how much can we get that is useful and not enough.
Yeah, there's some sort of diminishing return on adding an additional perspective. And I think it relates both to the current situation and sort of how much we can process and how far along something we're, sort of the momentum around the thing. There's some sense of, we tend to think about it as considering one more option ought to make us better off. But I think that in a lot of instances, we need to actually manage, there's an optimal point of differences. We want to avoid monocultures. Although monocultures also do have a few useful properties, I would say.
So monocultures are bad when you want to try and resist something that attacks an element of that monoculture. But monocultures are great when you want to do something very quickly at scale.
Exactly. So usually we tend to sort of talk about the problems with monocultures is that they're very susceptible to outside threats. So sort of they can't change easily because they all sort of, they're all specialized towards the same thing. And sort of when a new outside thing comes, it might actually wipe it out. So this happens a lot with crops and sort of farm animals and stuff like that. So that's sort of where most of the see how bad this is comes from. But what we forget is that it's also sort of, as you said, that's where massive efficiency also comes from, sort of doing the same thing and sort of knowing that all of these things are actually alike helps us optimize the momentum. So we need to sort of keep, we need to inject just enough differences in it. And I think this is actually also a part of how they make rocks think, sort of building computer chips, is that actually you have what is essentially a monoculture of silicon. But you dope it with foreign elements. You need to pick the exactly right ones, but if you do, it actually becomes massively smarter in a sense. And I think that's true for a lot of the efforts we have too. If you had too many perspectives, we can't process them all, we can't carry them all forth, we can't gain enough momentum around a singular idea to make it useful because we dilute the power we have. We just spend time trying to converge. But if we sort of tip over on the other end, we get fragile in another sense.
So I've been thinking so far in the conversation about when we start an idea, when we kick things off. There's also the advantage of a spanner in the works or someone wearing the, you know, one of De Bono's black hats or a devil's advocate. So one of those roles. So we could be, as a group, we've decided on something, we've got the requisite coherence around it and we're starting to move. I think there's value in bringing in other perspectives, wearing those different hats as well.
And I think that's useful. But when do we know, how do we know when to take the hat off? When do we know how to commit?
Okay. So are you saying, Toby, we could have someone wearing one of those black hats and all they do is argue with us all the way along the whole project?
I've had more than my fair share of film critics on projects, and I've probably been one at more than one occasion too, where sort of you go from being the needed dissent, questioning the idea or questioning the reason for doing this particular thing, and sort of you wear your black hat so proudly that you see it as your role to just constantly nag about all the things and all the reasons why this could be wrong, which also saps the effort of all its energy when we can't reach a point of, well, this is the best we know, let's commit to take a step and then reevaluate. So sort of there's something about that, that we can't silence the critique, but there's also a sort of, but how much of a running commentary does the critique need to be? And should it be someone that just gleefully tries to poke holes in everything we do? Because that turns fairly toxic too.
Yeah, it's kind of seductive, the seductiveness of the black hat, where you have this power, you've got the permission to say, this is wrong. And there's a lovely format of workshop called Ritual Dissent from Dave Snowden's work at Cognitive Edge. And what that is designed to do is to get people ditting. And I'd never heard the term ditting before. But ditting is where you kind of do a bit of one-upmanship. So think about, the fishing story on the weekend. I caught a fish, it was this big. And someone else goes, oh, that's nothing. I caught a fish and it was this big. Right? And then someone else goes, no, I caught a fish and it was this big. So in that workshop, what we actually want people to do when they're critiquing an idea is to start feeding off each other, because then where we get to is a point where we've actually shaken the idea quite strongly and found many holes in it that means we can make it more resilient with the next version of the idea. But even that's time boxed. So in that workshop, you don't let the ditting go on for hours and hours and hours. It's sort of a time of 3, maybe 10 minutes at the most. So it's always time bound. But there is that little seductiveness of being able to have permission to wear the black hat all the time.
Yeah, it's. I think that since I grew up as a developer, in a sense, in a community where one-upmanship was half of the game almost. poking holes in whatever people were doing, that's how you gain credibility in a sense. I'm happy we're at least in some sense past that point. But that's the seductiveness of the black hat, that you end up trying to poke holes in things. And you also end up with this overarching idea that if there's holes in the idea, then it can't be good enough. But quite often, sort of knowing where the holes are is useful and shouldn't actually stop you from making progress. You should sort of note the risk and go, it's good that we know that if this happens, we need to adjust. It's not a thing we actually need to adjust the model or adjust the idea for just yet. So there's a set of resilience in there, sort of it doesn't disqualify the idea. It's just sort of, yes, that's a known problem, and that might be okay. We also need that balancing voice.
So when you were talking about finding the holes in things, I was just thinking of a bag, right? I mean, you can't actually put anything into a bag unless it's got a hole in the top. And, you know, the plastic bag type idea with the holes near the top of the bag are actually the handles. But if you try to fill that bag completely with liquid, well, we know where the holes are. They're at the top. So the liquid's going to come out. Yeah, so I quite like that idea that it's okay to find the holes and to poke the holes and to be aware of the holes, but it still might be a useful thing of itself even with those holes in it.
Yeah, and bouncing off that bag idea, sort of if you go, well, let's fill the bag with liquid because we need to carry liquid somewhere, and someone goes, well, if you turn it upside down, there's a big hole in it and it will sort of all run out. And you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
that's okay. We shouldn't do that then. Yeah. And it's really occasionally we get so stuck on the, but what if you turn it upside down? Yeah, but just don't do that. So just let it go. It's okay. We know that. There's that about it. And sort of, I think that in this model breaking sense, I think I learned this from Chris Motz. He was talking then about options and testing, sort of how do you know that you're making progress towards strengthening an idea? Sort of how do you pick good examples? And I think this is partly what the Spanners in the Work should be trying to do, is find that model breaking example. Sort of, here's an example where the thing we're building breaks down. This teaches us something new about the thing, the idea. And then we also need to decide, okay, yes, that breaks the model. Is it relevant? Because that actually helps shape what it is we're trying to, sort of, we can say, no, that's actually out of bounds. And if we decide that it's out of bounds, then that just becomes a known constraint, but also probably a simplifying assumption around the thing we're constructing. Does that make sense?
I've got a phrase for you. The holes or the flaws help define the solutions. That's why the spanner in the works is a good idea. However, if it's only just to find fault without focus, it's detrimental. And as a side note, do you have a pocket knife?
Yes, I do.
All right. Okay. Now, to take devil's advocate, you know, spanner in the works, to the extreme example, you know those pocket knives with a spoon and a fork, and like they're massive and they're totally non-functional because they're so big and heavy to hold in your hand, you can't actually use it as a pocket knife?
I think I wanted one of those as a teenager,
yeah,
yes.
They were very popular about 30 years ago or something, right? But they're totally ineffectual because they've got so many options, they become cumbersome and difficult to wield or use. So, you know, the Swiss Army pocket knife is actually a very heavily pared down, but it got to a stage where they had like a compass in it and a big tablespoon and a fork and a knife, and it was like...
A bottle opener, everything.
You might as well have just brought a drawer from the kitchen. And brought all your knives and forks with you. But the idea
I've seen this IT system.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, that's the devil's advocate thing would say, well, why don't we just bring the cutlery drawer? Because really all we need is a knife, but we're kitchen sinking it. So to me, the idea of the holes is that the holes or the flaws in it help define your solution if you can stay focused and not get sidetracked by the holes. Avoid the black holes, they'll suck you in.
Yeah, but I think that that's super relevant, that I think that the process also needs to include exposing assumptions about where the goalposts are. Because a lot of the flaw finding, and this is a really handy tactic if you ever need to sort of get into one of these debates. If you can't find any flaws in the thing you're actually looking at, if you just move the goalposts slightly, then it's very easy to find problems with something. So you have a perfectly functional pocket knife and you can't find any problems with it, all you need to do is sort of go, there's not a compass in it.
Mm.
you've totally sort of moved from this is a useful knife, you can cut stuff with it, to sort of going, the problem is actually navigation. And of course, a pocket knife isn't a particularly good solution to a different problem. But since you felt free to change the problem, your critique seems really relevant. And often it's accepted just as a, oh yeah, didn't think about that. Let's just add a compass to it. So it's a way to sound very smart and sort of find faults too. It's also a way of avoiding actually the hard questions about what really ought to be the trade-offs for a good pocket knife.
The type of thing you're describing, Toby, is a nice way of provocation. So the idea is to, I like the idea of asking a different problem or framing it in a different problem light as a way of helping our brains get a bit more flexible with different ideas. So a bit more, the multiple perspectives and points of view can be helped by having something as provocative as, why doesn't this thing that we use as a knife help me to navigate? So it's actually a good question from that perspective. So long as it's time bound, because that's another seductive form of spanner in the works. It's really easy to just turn that into a lot of fun and a lot of weird stuff and end up not being productive. But it's really good if you just need to kind of shake your way out of some entrained thinking.
If we use the pocket knife idea, right? If someone asked, what tool would you use or take with you as a survival tool? Most people would say, well, a lot of us would say pocket knife would be something you'd want to have, right?
Mm.
Okay, so if you're saying, is it a good pocket knife and how do we design a better pocket knife? That's one statement. But if you come along and say, let's make a better survival tool, then you'll put a compass in the handle of a pocket knife.
And a sharpening stone.
And a sharpening. So yeah. You see how I think that's important, because it's what question you're asking. And it'll also highlight if people have a biased or almost a reactionary response in unison, pocket knife. But define your pocket knife and what are you using it for is very important. That's the spanner in the works idea. Trying to rephrase the question isn't actually problematic in itself, but it is good to have, like, do we want a pocket knife? Are we designing a pocket knife or a survivalist tool?
Yeah, and I think that's the really useful spanner in the works, or really useful additional perspective to sort of at least checkpoint that sort of, okay, is the problem really a better pocket knife, or is it the more general category of survival tools? So just sort of, are we solving the right problem? Is this a problem we want to be solving? Is it the right one? And being deliberate about that, because quite often we, especially when we're down and sort of looking at the details of our pocket knife, we actually forget to ask the question, but is a better pocket knife actually the problem we want to be solving? So I think that's a very, very useful perspective to bring up at some point, especially when you find yourself fairly far down in the weeds, sort of discussing the nitty-gritty, or when you're seeing that you're expanding considerable effort to sort of grow this concept or the model of this thing. Then sort of just, okay, but are we sure that it's actually a pocket knife that we want, that it's not sort of a survival tool?
So if we extrapolate a little bit from that, if we are asked a question and it has a very specific, like, design us a better pocket knife, that's a very specific question or task. But if you ask a question, how do we improve our abilities to survive, or make a more general question that's got a larger sphere, if everyone comes back asking a more general question and they have a very similar answer, there's a lot of unified voices saying pocket knife, then that's a warning flag. Maybe we should focus the question a little better.
Oh, okay, so what you're saying is we've got a very specific request.
That's fine.
Then we broaden the problem that we think we're trying to solve. And if everyone comes back with the same answer,
there's a problem.
Then we haven't asked the right question.
Exactly.
So we need a broad enough question that we get a few more perspectives and points of view, but not so much that we kind of diffuse it out.
In other words, it's the premise of, if you have 100% unified unity in your response and everyone agrees, you're probably 100% wrong. The more people that, you know, the less people debate something, the more it's probably built on pre-biases.
So I think that we need a healthy amount of debate in order to sort of, because that's the only way we can actually pressure test that we're doing the right thing. We need to be able to debate that, and then also come to agreement that it's either the right thing or not the right thing. And we need to sort of, to some extent, have bounds on that. But just to checkpoint that the reasoning you had there too, just for my own own understanding's sake, what I heard was essentially also, if we're given the task of creating a better pocket knife, and we set out to sort of, we send that question out to sort of the group tasked with this, and they all go, yes, we're doing a better pocket knife. That's problematic. But the reason I would say that it's problematic is because what none of them have actually answered is, what is a better pocket knife? What would make a pocket knife better? This is sort of the, I see this in retrospectives a lot, that people go, what's the reason to have a retrospective? To find better ways. And then you go, okay, can you please point me in the direction of better?
Yeah.
Yes. And what they don't know is how better actually looks like. They don't have a common theory of that. So we need to sort of find that first. Then we can sort of go, okay, let's go towards it.
This is the good thing of the pocket knife analogy, because it's really simple. There's only a few materials. Wood, if you've got a wooden handle or plastic, whatever. And the metal that it's made from, like the blade. So when you say make it better, one of the first things you would do is you look at the materials. How do we improve the actual materials used in it? And then it'll be design, form and function. So it's sort of very two broad categories that you'd focus on to make it better. Unless you want to put a compass in it, another story. I'm getting sidetracked, see? But,
Yeah, but the compass makes it better from a marketing perspective. It's probably easier. It's sort of, you can probably sell the compass kitchen sink spoon pocket knife to a completely new segment of customers.
Oh,
so
easy.
From that perspective, it's better. They have no intent of actually going out into the woods with it for any actual sort of real usage, but they do want to show it to their friends or talk about it, that they have the bestest pocket knife.
But then you have to have the reality that we're not designing a better pocket knife. We're designing a better marketable pocket knife, a saleable pocket knife. You know, like putting some popular cartoon character on it or something. it's not actually the better pocket knife. There's a lot to pull out of that, actually. All of the spanner. Well, in the, no pun intended with
this. You can pull a lot out of your pocket knife. Yes, that's sort of, that's how they wound up with a bad one.
I've actually got one. They're massive. They're you know, for a small kid of like 10 or 12, you can't hold the damn thing. It's just enormous. It's like a battleship.
So are we putting a spanner in the works or a pocket knife in the works?
The reason I like pocket knife was because I'm very well aware of those multifunction things that are just like the size of a hamburger. They're ridiculously large. And so that's the peril of having too many perspectives when you're discussing things. That's why the monoculture helps focus the need and the direction. The alternate version of the other person, the spanner, is actually more to focus the question.
Mm.
And I think it's a play between those two dynamics pulling at each other. So then again, I could be wrong. Silence, that's not good.
Oh, I'm wondering if we've...
This is my thinking face.
Yeah.
Well, you're on audio, so I can't see that.
Yeah, that's... I need to sort of think higher. I guess that's that problem.
I think that's actually a good conclusion from that, actually. Because the multifaceted or multi-perspective approach is fraught with peril because it divides attention.
Mm. So what I was thinking is that what I'm starting to sense an outline of in this is that one thing commonly said about critique is that the problem we have with a lot of the critique-like processes we have, code reviews, for example, is that we forget to focus on the thing and its use, and we start focusing on the person and taste and status and all of these other things. So the useful critique is always about the thing, and that's the same thing with ritual descent. It's the thing, what we're actually trying to do is not destroy the idea. We're trying to make the idea better.
Yes.
That's really important. When it becomes, I'm trying to destroy the thing, then you're in the realm of useless. But so you need to keep front and center that what you're doing is trying to improve the thing. And that's when the spanner in the works and the black hat, and as you phrased it here, what we're doing is actually, we're critiquing, in a sense, we're trying to find faults with it, but we're doing that also to clarify the question. When we're saying that bag doesn't carry liquid very well if you turn it upside down, we're also clarifying that, well, we're fine with the constraint of you holding it in the other set of holes at the top, because that's how you carry it. That becomes sort of part of the definition. It brings clarity to the problem statement that these are the constraints we're willing to work under in order to solve this particular thing. So then the dissent becomes about making the question better. And we also have the critique that is there to make the thing better.
I'm going to throw a spanner in the works.
That's your job.
That's my I know. I'm inane. It's basically it's a natural ability. Aptitude, that's the one. That's the word. How do you know when you're trying to design something or get together and work with a group of people, how do you know when the critique becomes negative, when it flips to the dark side, so to say? So how do you define the motivation behind the question? Told you I was a spanner.
I'll answer a different question.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, that's usually what I do. When I don't have a good answer to the one you're asking, I'll answer one that I would like to ask. So what I tend to say is that you're not delivering software unless you're delivering software. And how does that connect to the thing you actually tried to ask me about? Well, I think that's part of how do we know that the group is going in the wrong direction, or that it's sort of becoming unproductive in sort of trying to better itself or better the ideas, or sort of it's when it fails to deliver, when it fails to make progress for some bounded period of time. And I think this is where Kim's ideas of sort of we must ensure that there's time boxes on these things, then that's when we know that it's going sort of nowhere for a particular value of nowhere. If we're spending so much time debating other things that we're not making progress towards the group's goal, then we have a problem.
It's the term analysis paralysis. So you get so hung up on thinking about it and exploring it that you don't actually get anything done.
Yeah, but what I've noticed with most people is they're very easily distracted by, for want of a better term, the politics of stuff, of debating. They sort of encamp themselves in a particular mindset and they'll argue that till they're blue in the face, even if facts go against what they're holding as true. I'm still, you know, yes, you can put it in a time box, but people have a habit of moving or turning back the time on the time boxes. So it's like they get distracted, go off on a tangent, and they'll isolate that off.
It's also the difference between trying to do something by consensus and trying to collaborate usefully. So a lot of people muddle the terms together. So a lot of people think if I've got a group of 10 people, we all have to be in absolute 100% agreement before we can take a step forward. But that's not necessarily always the best way to do something. So I think where this conversation is starting to go is in that realm, because I think that's what you're talking about, Stephen, is people may feel that if they're trying to reach consensus, then that's when they'll argue black and blue with each other about things to try and get it to be their way if not everyone in the group is agreeing.
I think basically most people, I mean, you've got a website called Comfortable Ambiguity, so fair enough, right? But most people aren't comfortable and they feel like they're losing something if not everyone agrees with them 100%. And that's very dangerous. So I'm a firm believer you can have a nice discussion, but there has to be like a controller, someone driving it, someone that has the, is like the traffic operator. They know the situation better than most people and then they're asking for like consultation. But if you throw the keys to everybody and everyone can drive the car, they're all going to jump in the driver's seat.
So, Kim, since you're the way better facilitator among us, I'll just direct this question over to you, because this is what I think. This is my vague idea of the value of a good facilitator, is that they are the party that can play in a setting like that one, this one. They can be the one that says, that's an interesting conversation, but it's not the one we're here to have. That's sort of, this is a sidetrack. It might be an interesting sidetrack. Do you want to switch to that one, or do you want to postpone it, or what do you want to do with it to keep the conversation focused on making progress?
So I would call it, maybe not a term everyone likes, but I would call it governance. So when we go into a meeting, we don't normally talk about how we're going to govern the decision making in that meeting. In contrast, when I facilitate a workshop, I generally write up a facilitation plan. I work with the people who've engaged me to design the workshop, and I make sure that the activities that we're going to be doing are time boxed and are designed in a way that is most likely to achieve the outcome and objectives for that workshop. Now, that doesn't mean the outcomes and objectives are preset beforehand. So as a facilitator, because I design the workshop, I write up the facilitation plan, and then I facilitate it to that plan, I've been given permission by the group that have engaged me to govern that process. So yes, having a facilitator means that you've designed and you've agreed and you are happy to have that governance in place. But a lot of meetings that we go into, we don't even talk about how we're going to govern them. And so I think that's when people get confused about whether we're going for consensus or consultation or whatever. So that's where I think the differences are.
So would that sort of be like what you're saying is that the group gives you the power to, in a sense, act as the referee to ensure that everyone actually plays the game fairly? And what happens a lot, sort of most of the time, since we don't have facilitators as an explicit role in the meeting, we end up playing essentially a pickup game of random people without a referee. And as long as we all agree on the rules, and as long as the stakes aren't that high, it turns out okay. But once the stakes raises, or when once we start spiraling out of control, we actually see that weakness in the setup, but we don't actually consciously anchor it to the lack of a referee or facilitator in this case.
Or a lack of agreed governance. So you don't need to have a facilitator if you're in a session where everyone, as you say, agrees on the rules and the governance is who makes the decisions and how decisions get made is clear.
So essentially we can, what we need is a shared foundation of these are the rules of engagement. This is how we're going to play this. And this is how we're deciding to decide. That's the important bit. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds fair. I'm stuck in chemistry. Sorry, I went off on a little tangent. Because when you said facilitator, I think catalyst. Right. And the definition of a catalyst basically is, a catalyst is a chemical compound which lowers the energy required to generate the product that you're looking for and then is not changed in the process itself or partakes other than lowering the energy, and then it comes out again. That's the rough one, right? So a facilitator follows that form, but the beautiful thing about a catalyst is they're specific to product you want to generate. So it's sort of important to get the facilitator attuned to the outcome you're aiming for. And that's why I think you need, that's why you brought in governance. To me, that's like picking the right catalyst for the chemical equation I want to generate the product for. It's that same idea that if you pick the wrong catalyst, you might end up with the wrong product at the end of it rather than, or it'll actually be consumed in the reaction rather than act as a catalyst.
Oh, I think that I'm currently seeing this as two relevant but separate things. The governance process, be that defined rules or a facilitator, helps us have a gainful conversation and sort of steers the process. That's actually monitoring the chemical reaction in this case, sort of keeping it doing its thing. The catalyst is actually an outside influence usually that adds to it. So that's usually the role that you can use an external expert or some inspirational speaker or these change agent consultancy people. They bring in new ideas to help the rest of the room start their thinking and sort of make the most of all of their expertise, and sort of they contribute to the reaction but aren't consumed by it, so to speak. So it's a really relevant thing. And I think that, of course, in a lot of workshop designs, you might end up playing these dual roles because you set the stage and you've already collected sort of reactive agents that you can sort of insert into it. And then you sort of stir the pot or you just keep it sort of brewing within limits. But yes, very useful.